The very last thing that John Podesta just said is no individual too big to jail. That should include people like Hillary Clinton. I mean, five people around her have been given immunity, to include her former chief of staff. When you are given immunity, that means that you've probably committed a crime. So, you know, I don't know how he can sit there and say something like that with all of the things that have been going around, just swirling around Hillary Clinton.
That's General Michael Flynn on Meet the Press last September. And despite those thoughts on immunity, that you only ask for it if you've committed a crime, Flynn himself has requested immunity in exchange for his testimony before Congress. He'd be talking about his ties to Russia, ties that got him fired by the Trump administration last month. And Flynn is not the only member of the Trump team that has some connection to Russia. There's President Trump's senior advisor slash son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Turns out Kushner met with a Russian bank executive in December, but never disclosed that meeting to lawmakers. We have a lot of news here, so we wanted to bring in a few guests to help us sort it all out. Joining us now is Philip Bump, national correspondent with The Washington Post. Welcome to you.
Thank you, ma'am.
And Yohei Driessen, foreign editor at Fox. Welcome to you. He'll be joining us in a few. And Jane Chong, deputy managing editor of Lawfare. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with you. When there is this offer to testify in exchange for immunity, what does that mean? What does it mean legally?
So I think we should first step back. Legally, we're not sure yet because it's not really clear whether there's been like a formal request for immunity. All we have really is this really splashy statement by Flynn's lawyer making it really clear that Flynn has something to say. We have no way of knowing like what it is or anything like that. We just know that the lawyer thought it was smart to make it enticing for Congress, perhaps.
Right. So for Congress to maybe take the bait, and then that would preclude the testimony being used in a criminal trial later down the line.
Well, it depends on what kind of immunity we're talking about. There's a difference between use and transactional immunity. Use immunity would protect Flynn from the government's use of his testimony for prosecuting him, whereas transactional immunity is sweeping immunity. It protects the witness from being prosecuted for offenses related to that testimony.
So that would be like a carte blanche immunity.
That's right. Interestingly, though, that difference might not be so obvious if we're talking about him getting immunity from Congress. And this is where the Oliver North stuff comes in. A lot of people have been talking about Oliver North, who was the NSC staffer who testified before Congress for the Iran-Contra affair. He was given use immunity by Congress while a criminal investigation into him was going on. However, the problem, of course, is when you're testifying before Congress and you have this testimony going out there, it's hard to show that witnesses against you didn't use your statements. And so what ended up happening is the D.C. Circuit overturned his conviction because it couldn't be shown that witnesses didn't use his testimony.
He ended up not spending any time in jail at all.
That's
Oliver
right.
North,
so
right?
Use and transactional, like there is a difference, but it can get really sticky.
Okay, so this is getting really into the weeds, and we haven't even gotten to the point where he is going to be granted immunity. In fact, it seems quite the opposite, Philip Bump. At least the Senate Intelligence Committee is saying no thanks, right?
Well, so far they're saying we haven't come to any determination, but it seems unlikely. I mean, the process by which he would be granted immunity requires 2/3 of the committee members that are leading the investigation to agree to it. It seems extremely unlikely that, barring him having some information that, you know, would lead fairly quickly to you know, the impeachment of the president, that the Democrats would be willing to vote in favor of him getting immunity. It seems as though there's not much indication from what I have heard and from the experts that I've spoken with, that this is a sincere attempt to get immunity from criminal prosecution, but it may, in fact, be, to the point that was just made, an attempt to try and potentially get this congressional immunity, although that seems like a long shot, too.
Right. And so, and usually when you're asking for immunity, don't you usually ask in private, that you don't make such a public declaration?
That's right. So there is generally what happens in the determination of whether or not someone gets immunity is that someone will go in and sit down with the prosecutors, and they're given sort of an immunity for the moment to discuss what it is that they know and who it is that they might be able to implicate with their information. And then there is an agreement that is made called a proffer agreement, in which the prosecutors agree not to actually bring charges based on the information that they have, although they generally leave open the option of pressing charges on other things in the future. And the goal there is to try and get someone who is more senior or more important than the person with whom they're speaking. So, for example, these are the sorts of things that happen in the, you know, in mob trials and things like this, potentially, you know, when you're trying to bring down the big boss. And the question I spoke with a lawyer this morning, the point he raised is that Michael Flynn is pretty senior. There aren't many people that he could be targeting that his testimony could be useful against, with the exception of Donald Trump, which suggests that either he's got something against Trump, which seems like the odds of that are fairly low, or he doesn't really have anything at all, and he's just trying to cover his own tail.
For future criminal prosecution, for other things, perhaps. Okay. All right. Well, let's bring in Yohei Driesen now. He is a foreign editor at Vox. Hi, Yohei.
Hi.
Okay, so let's talk about this in the larger context. And I just want you to discuss this idea that, well, he's trying to cover up something or cover his rear, as Philip has intimated, for a future criminal prosecution. What could he be tried for when it comes to Russia?
So as with so many Washington scandals, including the Bill Clinton impeachment, it's likelier that he would be tried for lying to the FBI than for anything actually tied to communications he may have had with Russia. Mm-hmm. It's not clear at all that the talks he had with the Russian ambassador were illegal, that any part of the discussion of it was illegal. Certainly lying to Mike Pence, which is what got him fired, is not illegal. Lying to the FBI is massively illegal. So when he's talking about seeking an immunity deal, it's nearly 100% likely that the crime that he feels like he's vulnerable towards being charged about is lying to the FBI. And that's something that, as we know from the Clinton impeachment and other high-profile trials, the FBI takes very seriously and pursues very, very strongly.
Okay, well, let's talk about some other members of the Trump campaign have also agreed to speak with Congress. There's the former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, also two of Trump's former advisors, Carter Page and Roger Stone. Let's begin with Manafort. What ties does he possibly have to Russia, and what could he possibly talk about in front of the committees?
Manafort is one of the people who has the most visible ties to Russia. It's worth just reminding very briefly who he was, because Trump went through so many campaign managers during the campaign. But he was the campaign manager.
Okay, it seems, Yohei, are you still there? It seems that we have temporarily lost Yohei Driesen. Philip Bump, I want to turn back to you and play a clip of tape now of Sean Spicer, who was asked today during the press briefing whether the president thought Flynn was guilty of a crime. And here's how Spicer responded.
I'm not going to give Mike Flynn or anyone else legal advice from the podium, but I will tell you that the president's view is he should go up there, he should testify.
Okay, so Philip, what is in it for Donald Trump to want Flynn to testify with or without immunity?
Well, I think that there are two different things here. What Spicer just said is sort of different than what Trump himself said on Twitter today. And what Spicer said is he wants Flynn to go testify. If you are a normal political actor, which Sean Spicer is more so than his boss, you want to at least give the impression you're doing everything in your human power to advance an investigation which will exonerate you. And part of that means encouraging people who may have information to go and testify. Whether or not you really want them to, you at least have to present that face that you want all of the information to get out. I think that's what Spicer's doing. That said, this morning Donald Trump said he thought that Flynn should make a deal and get immunity to go testify, and the reason he thought he should seek immunity was because this was a, quote, witch hunt. And essentially what he's implying is that there is a partisan bias to this investigation, which is meant to impugn him and his electoral victory, and so he is using this immunity claim as sort of a blanket excuse for why this whole thing is a fake investigation that shouldn't be happening anyway.
Yeah, calling it a witch hunt. But this doesn't help that this is front and center every day in these White House press briefings.
Well, that's the amazing and baffling thing about Donald Trump's tweet this morning is that he's consistently very good at stepping on his own good news or making things worse for himself through his tweets. I think that's what he did today. He was supposed to be talking about manufacturing today. Sean Spicer led off talking about, you know, economic confidence and so on and so forth. They're supposed to be talking about manufacturing. But once again, the whole day is being driven not only by the fact that we learned last night that Flynn was seeking this immunity, but then by Donald Trump doubling down on it as well.
Right. And then we also have these dueling committee meetings in the Senate and the House, intelligence investigations in the House and the Senate. The House one seems to have stalled and has gotten really caught up in politics. What do you think is going to happen there next week in terms of whether or not these investigations will be back on course, either in the House, and I believe there will be some testimony in the Senate, right, next week?
Yeah, I mean, the Senate one seems to be progressing in the way that such investigations normally do. And there's actually a good piece in the Post yesterday that sort of drew a contrast between how the Senate is operating and how the House is operating. The House one has gotten very much bogged down in the fact that the chairman of the committee, Devin Nunes, who represents Central Valley of California, has, as I'm sure most people are aware by now, he received some information from some actor within the White House complex, which he suggested to the press exonerated Donald Trump's claims of having been wiretapped, although we haven't really seen that evidence, and it's not really clear who gave him the information. And there are all these questions that have arisen about Nunes' leadership of the committee. They canceled a bunch of hearings, and it's not really clear why they canceled the hearings. So the House side is a total disaster, but the Senate side is continuing apace. They had hearings yesterday. It seems as though they are actually doing an investigation. It's the sort of thing that really the White House should be championing, because it still is being led by Republicans, but it's, you know, sort of progressing forward in the way that you would expect. But everyone, all this drama on the House side is sort of gathering everyone's attention.
Right. And so who will testify, at least on the Senate side, who could shed some light on this?
Honestly, I don't remember who's scheduled to testify over the short term at the Senate next week. But, you know, you had just started to walk through some of the actors who were supposed to be going and presenting testimony to Congress. Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn probably will still end up giving testimony, whether or not he receives immunity. There are a lot of people who are involved to some extent in this thing who can talk to these committees and share what they know. We're not clear yet, though, what they're going to say.
Okay. I think we have Yohei Driesen back on the line now. Hi, Yohei.
Hi.
Sorry we lost you there. So you were talking about Paul Manafort and what he could possibly talk about in his testimony.
Yeah, I mean, just that there are several people in the orbit who we know for sure had some contacts with Russia. Paul Manafort is one, Carter Page is another, Roger Stone is a third. So among the people who we know will be testifying, at least in closed doors to the Senate and House probes, Jared Kushner is another on that list who has voluntarily agreed to come forward. So there's this orbit of people who have had some connection post-campaign. Jared Kushner had ties and had some conversations during the transition. But then there's this trio that we know factually, without any question, had some types of communications with Russia, either directly or indirectly, during or before the campaign. That's Manafort, that's Carter Page, and that's Roger Stone. So I think as we're sort of looking at this giant orbit of people around Trump, it's important to differentiate between the ones whose conversations after the election are under investigation and the ones whose conversations before the election are really a source of investigation.
And what is the underlying question with both of those?
I mean, the underlying question for the ones sort of after the election really is about, did they lie? You know, did they mislead the FBI? Did they mislead the president? Was there improper discussion about lifting sanctions, which could be in violation of a very rarely prosecuted thing called the Logan Act? But the real question, the million-dollar question, the billion-dollar question, the trillion-dollar question is, was there active collusion? Meaning, did Russian intelligence have files, then say to the Trump campaign, we've got this stuff, what should we leak and when? Or on the other side, do the Trump campaign say to Russia, boy, it would be great if you could find something damaging on Hillary in the DNC email and sort of direct the Russians about what to hack and what to look for? I mean, that's the question. Because then you get to what theoretically rises to one of the great political scandals in American history of a campaign colluding with a very hostile foreign power to sway an American election.
But will any of these witnesses actually admit to any of that when they are testifying before Congress? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you can only find through wiretap conversations and the like?
For sure. I mean, it's impossible to imagine that Paul Manafort will take the oath. First of all, a lot of these conversations will be behind closed doors in the first place, but even in, for the rare ones, maybe in public, I agree completely. It's hard to imagine that they'll take the oath, sit down, and then say, yes, we cheated and we collaborated with the Russians. Ultimately, this will come down to what the FBI finds and what its intercepts show, and what the House and Senate intel, what their investigators, especially on the Senate side, since the House side is a circus, it will ultimately come down to the intelligence that was gathered. There's no way that they will publicly admit to this unless they're forced to.
Yeah. And so how long do you expect this to carry on?
The amazing thing about FBI espionage investigations is that these can take years. So it's theoretically possible that Trump, let's say he doesn't run for re-election, that it's 2021 and we have a new president, and only then do we discover that the FBI believes that there was or was not collusion. It's possible this one might go more quickly. They may feel like they are close to having the goods or may already have the goods, in which case maybe this comes in a matter of months. But these cases typically take years to really get to the bottom of. So I don't think we're going to find out anytime soon.
Yohei Driesen, foreign editor at Vox. Philip Bump, national correspondent with The Washington Post. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
And thanks also to Jane Chong. We heard from her earlier, deputy managing editor of Lawfare. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the ties between the Trump camp and Russia? So many ties that keep popping up. You can comment on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how the Owens River Valley, that's up near Mammoth, is planning for a record snowmelt. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The dried up Owens Valley is dried up no longer. Yesterday, Frank Gerke, California's chief snow surveyor, measured the snowpack in the small town of Phillips in the Sierra. It was 94 inches, more than double the normal level. So the worry now isn't about too little water, but about too much. About a million cubic feet of water is expected to run off the Sierra Nevada mountains in the coming months. And here to talk about what that might mean for the people in the Owens Valley and how they're preparing for the big snowmelt are Kevin Caruncio, administrative officer of Inyo County. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Louis Sahagan, reporter for the LA Times. Welcome to you.
Nice to be here.
Kevin, let's begin with you. What are you doing to prepare?
Right now, we're having regular operational pre-planning meetings with local and state partners. That includes, of course, the City of Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, tribal officials, agencies like Caltrans and Southern California Edison, as well as the City of Bishop.
Okay. And what's the worst-case scenario?
Well, the real worst-case scenario is that with 200 to 250% of snowpack in the Sierra, that it all comes down at once due to very warm temperatures, warm rain, or a combination of the two. And in that case, we'd be looking at localized flooding, damages to bridges, roadways, Highway 395. That's an absolute worst-case scenario unless you start getting into dam failures or anything like that, and that's a completely different ballgame.
Well, are you worried about that?
Not right now. You know, we've worked closely with Southern California Edison that just went through some dam upgrades on their lakes, South Lake and Sabrina Lake right now. But it's something we certainly need to look at in the pre-planning stage in terms of, you know, if something like that catastrophic were to happen, where's that water going to go and how are we going to respond to it?
Yeah. And Louis, you recently traveled the 395 up through the valley there, talked to people about the possibilities of flooding. And what are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing is a combination of, you know, real concern over a threat that Mayor Garcetti recently described as, and these are his words, conditions of extreme peril, quote unquote, facing LA's water collection and distribution system up there, because all of that water could overwhelm its capacity and indeed, you know, cause serious flooding. However, this is an area where residents have been wary of large-scale, and particularly large-scale projects by DWP, going all the way back to 1913 when it completed the Los Angeles Aqueduct System. And that is because of the way that LA officials posed as ranchers and farmers to buy land and water rights in the area with a goal, a secret goal of completing the aqueduct to meet the needs of that growing metropolis 200 miles to the south. Now, that kind of skepticism and wariness lingers to this very day, and in part because even after the aqueduct was built, which drained much of the Owens River and rendered Owens Lake, a vast lake, dry as a bone, nearly, later, long legal battles were required to force the DWP to rewater parts of the Owens Lake and the Owens River, 62-mile stretch of the Owens River. So nothing comes without, it seems, or so people believe, a hidden agenda if the directive is coming from L.A. And then to figure that out and remedy it locally often takes long, you know, court battles.
Right. And so this emergency declaration, the conditions of extreme peril, as the mayor has called it, does that give the DWP leeway to maybe conduct projects that they wouldn't normally have been allowed to do?
That is another concern among skeptics in Owens Valley. So we know that the threat is very, very real, very serious. However, there are concerns that the LADWP might somehow use the extensive powers that are granted by an emergency declaration to get projects through, to build things that it had wanted to do over the decades but was unable to do. For example, build roads out on Owens Dry Lake where they do a lot of dust mitigation projects. But building those roads has been, that idea has been rejected by the State Lands Commission, which owns the lake bed out there. There also, LADWP some years ago wanted to build a large pump back station at the southern end of the lower Owens River that would pump water back into the river and send it to L.A., I mean into the aqueduct, send it to L.A., a much larger pump-back station than exists there today. Now, LADWP insists, no, we're not going to do any such thing. We do need this emergency declaration to bolster the aqueduct. By doing that, it ensures the safety of L.A.'s water supply as well as the safety of locals, you know, enhanced safety from flooding.
And Kevin, what do you say about that? Do you trust the DWP?
Well, that's sort of a loaded question. You know, what I'll say to that is, you know, Inyo County in the Owens Valley is no stranger to local emergencies. In the last decade, I've been involved in assisting the Board of Supervisors in proclaiming more than a dozen local emergencies. We have five going. And the thing I really want to start off by saying is that in those emergency events, whether they're fires or floods or mud flows, the county has no better partner than the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power in responding to those immediate threats. What's unique in this situation is we know that the snowpack's up there. We know what could happen. And so we're in this pre-planning phase. And sometimes, you know, that, you know, gives rise to, you know, a lot of other concerns. The City of Los Angeles proclamation of emergency only has force and effect within the territorial limits of the city. So it's very good for assisting the department in what it might need to do in terms of contracting or purchasing or budget. But it does not have any force and effect up here in Inyo County. Last Tuesday, the Inyo County Board of Supervisors proclaimed the threatened existence of a local emergency in anticipation of flooding to work cooperatively with LA on the pre-planning, mitigation, and prevention measures that are in everyone's interest. You know, so when we talk about, you know, damage to public infrastructure, a lot of that damage, depending on how things happen, could actually be to the City of Los Angeles's water gathering and transportation capabilities, you know, where Los Angeles gets its water flow from. Ironically, the same thing we're going to be relying on for a lot of flood control up here is that same collection and conveyance apparatus. So a lot of our focus right now is trying to work to ensure that DWP is able to operate its ditches, canals, and spreading structures as efficiently as possible. And the good thing is that, you know, when those are working, it really recharges the aquifer that everyone relies upon in drier years mm-hmm. for groundwater pumping.
Yeah. Louis, you also visited Manzanar, the historic site where Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. Is there some fear there that that could be damaged?
The fear being expressed by officials at the Manzanar National Historic Site is echoed by residents from one end of Owens Valley to the other. And that is that since a lot of the attention from DWP in terms of clearing culverts, getting ready for this massive amount of water by clearing culverts, by, you know, dredging canals, by protecting its dust mitigation apparatus on the dry lake in various ways, is overlooking the immediate concerns of residents and places like Manzanar. So they would like to see more proactive flood control measures being taken by DWP right outside of the boundaries of Manzanar, for example, where there are a couple of streams prone to flooding that are outside of the boundaries of Manzanar, which is a federal government site. So they want DWP to get out there and do more work to make sure they don't get hit by floods, since it's their water and their conveyance system.
Yeah.
So that is a concern. Also, this problem is already causing putting a dent in the local tourism economy. The Chamber of Commerce in Bishop, California, for example, recently had to cancel a trout fishing derby scheduled for March 11 because the stretch of the Owens River that they use for that event is jumping its banks. And that has cost Bishop $300,000 this year.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there with the trout. Louis Sahagan, reporter for the LA Times. Kevin Carrencio, administrative officer of Inyo County. Thank you both very much.
You're very welcome. But we are on track for a spectacular summer up here. The flowers, waterfalls, and all the fish that weren't caught during the derby are just waiting for visitors.
Okay. We're heading up there. Thank you. All right. Coming up on the program, Hollywood is accused of whitewashing again. Scarlett Johansson stars in Ghost in the Shell, is casting her in a Japanese role the only thing perceived as problematic with the movie?
She does look naked. I mean, it's distracting.
Film.
Yes, with little seams, though. So that's how you know she's not naked. It's sort of like a Barbie doll.
New movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. Time to talk about this week's new releases. Mary Jedekin is here. She's riding solo.
I'm riding
it's
solo
just
today.
Just you. She's Yay. The host and producer for Fandemonium on HitFix and host of YouTube's Girls on Film. It's so nice to have you.
Nice to be here, as always.
Well, let's talk about the first big movie of the weekend, Ghost in the Shell. It's a Japanese comic franchise that got the Hollywood treatment and now stars Scarlett Johansson.
We saved you. And now you save others.
Everything they told you was a lie.
You had a family.
Remember that.
What do you want from me?
They did not save your life. They stole it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued. Should I be intrigued?
On a certain very basic, shallow level, you can be intrigued. You're allowed.
I want to know how they stole her life.
So the premise for people who aren't familiar, Ghost in the Shell originally was a Japanese manga, like a comic book that came out in the late 80s,
right.
And was later made into an animated film and has since grown a huge fan base and is often regarded as one of the most influential of the manga to kind of permeate Western culture. And now this is sort of the latest iteration. And sadly, it's it's kind of more Shell than Ghost. The premise is basically we're in a very kind of distant future where there are robots and machines have sort of melded with humanity, and the lines are really blurred. It's an AI kind of moral story of what happens when humanity is sort of the gray areas around humanity and robotics are really blurred. And Scarlett Johansson plays the Major, who is a character who believes one thing until she realizes another thing. I don't want to give too much away. She basically works for the good guys and thinks that she's kind of a sort of enhanced sort of assassin spy who is supposed to fight evil. And let's just say the people who she thinks are good guys are maybe not good guys, and the people who are bad guys are maybe good guys. And there's a lot of that kind of reversal. It feels very redundant because it is redundant. It's not only a remake, but these are themes that have been played out in numerous films and comic books before. What you will get is beautiful visuals. It's a stunning film to look at. Clint Mansell did the score. He did Requiem for a Dream. So musically, it's wonderful. But that's kind of, for me, where the joy in the experience ended. One of the things I loved about the film was often something you would see in Japanese animation. The style is gritty. There's a lot of like quivering camera work, and you really feel like the visuals are alive. Here, it felt really slick, almost too slick. And, you know, Scarlett Johansson is in a bodysuit.
Well,
for much of the film.
So she's literally dipped in a white body shell. So whitewashed.
Yes, quite literally.
I mean, and there's been a lot of controversy over a Western actress playing this character, not an Asian actress.
Well, this is nothing new in Hollywood, sadly, but now we are kind of finally paying more attention to when lead actors are playing roles that are meant to be Asian. We saw it with Doctor Strange last year. And going back decades, I mean, there's many examples. And I think it's really good that the conversation is continuing. I think it's really unfortunate that it's still happening and that we still have to be having this conversation. It would be nice to kind of just see a little bit more inclusion and diversity in all films. But when you look at this from a production standpoint, two Chinese financing and production companies were involved in the making of this film. And my feeling is that Scarlett Johansson was probably cast for financial reasons. She is a huge star. She has international appeal. So I think, sadly, these decisions get made based on bottom line sort of revenue and not on what is, you know, maybe
also
right.
It looks like she's naked.
She does look naked. I mean, it's distracting.
Film.
Yes. With little seams, though. So that's how you know she's not naked. It's sort of like a Barbie doll. Like, there's no distinguishing features on the human body that make her look human, but still naked-esque.
Okay, let's move on to a Holocaust film. This is starring Jessica Chastain. Here's a clip from The Zookeeper's Wife.
You can never tell who your enemies are or how to trust. Maybe that's why I love animals so much. You look in their eyes, and you know exactly what's in their hearts.
Okay, Jessica Chastain doing her best Polish accent. This is based on a true story from the book, the Diane Ackerman book, about a real-life couple who rescued about a couple hundred Jews in Warsaw during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They ran a zoo, and...
And the war breaks out. So you have this woman, Antonina, who's played by Jessica Chastain, who no matter what she does is captivating. So watching her is enjoyable, even though the accent, for me personally, having sort of Polish roots and Eastern European roots, felt a bit grating at times. It's a tough accent to pull off. The thing about this movie is it tells an interesting story. I like the fact that it's the story of a woman and a woman in a position of relative authority and how she kind of finds her way through the war and how she figures out what her purpose is. And that's all, you know, fine and well. The animals element is great. I mean, I love animals. So for me, watching animals suffer is horrifying as much as watching humans suffer. I think with The Zookeeper's Wife, we get a sense of where Poland was right before the war. The things it does well is it explores the fact that Jews and Gentiles were coexisting in Poland. Mm-hmm. And when the war broke out, a lot of people who were Gentiles, as it were, had to watch their Jewish friends and peers be carted off. And what some of them did and what others did varies greatly. The couple that ran this zoo lost all their animals, and I must warn people in the audience that there is a lot of animal brutal violence, and I wasn't expecting it. It's a PG-13 film, so just be warned if you're going to see this.
But this is the Holocaust, and there obviously was more human violence in
real
life.
There was.
Is that portrayed?
It is. It's strikingly more violent than I thought it was going to be. And I'm actually glad in a way, because yeah. I feel like to soften it would have done a few disservices. One, we can't soften the Holocaust. And two, it is a woman's story. So I feel like that would be a very stereotypical way to treat a female experience of the Second World War. It's beautiful visually. For me, it felt a little bit heavy-handed in terms of some of the violence and some of the emotional beats of the film. The villain is very villainous, which is often the case with World War II movies. It's kind of hard not to completely vilify a Nazi character. And I think
so. It's not very subtle, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it lacks nuance. Let's put it that way. I normally love Jessica Chastain, and this again, I felt a little distance from her. I don't know why. I felt like I could have been more connected to her character. I certainly felt connected to her love of animals, but, you know.
Who doesn't like a cute animal?
Who doesn't like a baby lion? I mean, a lion cub is cute.
All right. Something somewhat related. This is a documentary about films made during World War II. It's called Five Came Back from Netflix. Tell us about that.
This is probably one of the most interesting kind of documentaries, long-form documentaries I've watched in a while. It's five directors speaking about five directors that experienced the Second World War in various ways, as filmmakers, as men. It's basically Steven Spielberg talking about William Wyler. You have Guillermo del Toro talking about Frank Capra. You have John Huston being discussed by Francis Ford Coppola. John Ford is explored by Paul Greengrass. It's a fascinating documentary from a structural standpoint, because it blends this sort of film masterclass, a cinematic masterclass, with an historical documentary.
And they're looking at their work around World War II?
Yes. It starts with, and I don't want to give too much away, but it basically starts with the lead up to the Second World War. So you're getting a sense of where these five directors were when the Second World War broke out, and how they managed wartime, how they got involved with the Second World War, the films they made, but also how the war influenced their careers after and the films they made after. So there are a couple of really fascinating moments. I can touch on a few. We get a real deep dive on John Ford's making of the Battle of Midway and how it influenced Paul Greengrass in documentary. So we get simultaneously filmmakers talking about how these films and how the work from these filmmakers influenced them, and how they are so modern, and how so many of their filmmaking techniques still are in use today. And we also get a real sense of history and what was happening in Hollywood at the time of the Second World War. How did Hollywood get involved? So you get all of these incredible tidbits of information.
And then this was made also in for propaganda reasons, right?
Yes.
Because Hitler was making his own films with Leni Riefenstahl.
Exactly. So I think what the American government started to realize was that they needed to step into the game. And they were also, this was a time when cinema and film was new. It was a very new cutting-edge technology. It was a new art form, and people were starting to realize that it not only was something people enjoyed, but it also shaped the consciousness of the country. Really interesting, very immersive, very in-depth documentary. If you're a film fan, it's kind of a must-see.
Okay, that sounds incredible.
Yes.
And you don't have to leave the house. So let's talk about one last movie where you will have to leave the house if you want to see it. This is called The Boss Baby. It stars Alec Baldwin as a baby.
I've got to deal with the KID.
You can talk!
Goo goo gaga.
No, you can really talk.
Fine, I can talk. Now let's see if you can listen. Get me a double espresso and see if there's some place around here with decent sushi. I'd kill for a spicy tuna roll right about now.
Okay, so this is an animated movie, by the way.
In case that wasn't clear.
So what's happening here?
That's a really good question. This has one of the busier plots of any animated film I think I've ever seen. Basically, The Boss Baby is about a little boy named Tim who has a very idyllic life. He's 7 years old. He's an only child. His parents sing him Blackbird by the Beatles every night. He's loving life. And all of a sudden, one day, a cab pulls up and out pops this baby in a suit I think smoking a cigar. If not, he should have been walking with a little briefcase, and he takes over. And very quickly, we realize that this is from the perspective of the 7-year-old. And this is a concept that I think the promise of this premise is much greater than the result, because they didn't really take that idea far enough. We get the idea that Tim, in his mind, this baby is coming and is going to take over his life. So a lot of the plot, we realize, is probably the invention of the 7-year-old, and it's hinted at that that's the case. But they don't ever really push that far enough. And the result is something that's kind of muddled and confusing. I think that there are some elements that work. I think there's some imaginative elements, and the sort of treatment of a 7-year-old's mind is fun and engaging. Some of the jokes do pay service to the grown-ups in the audience. There's a Glengarry Glen Ross reference and a lot of sort of MBA corporate culture and greed jokes that some work, some fall flat. And that's sort of the baseline for the rest of the film. It feels a bit inconsistent. It feels very busy. It kind of devolves in the third act into just an action kind of set piece that ends in sort of resolution. But you have to also buy the concept that babies are made in a factory in a sky. And they do kind of talk about the idea that Tim has been told how babies are really made, but he still believes that babies come from some weird corporation in the sky. So again, there's a lot of competing ideas and themes that for grown-ups are going to be kind of muddling and weird. And kids might enjoy this film. I think it's one of those movies that I think my kids would probably get lost because the plot is so busy and so chock full of, well, we have to go here and we have to go there and now we're doing this and now we're doing that. But there's no real emotional progression that matches those plot points. I know that sounds kind of sophisticated for an animated film, but there does need to be some cohesion. And I feel like Inside Out is an example of a film that did a really good job of delving into the mind of a child in a way that felt inventive and immersive and something globally appealing to a huge audience. Here, I feel like it's a very sort of half-hearted attempt at that, and you can feel it. It's a mess.
Although you can't not think of Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump now.
Yes.
Whenever you hear his voice.
Yes, and there are some parallels to the sort of greed, corporate kind of things that he does with both characters. I mean, Alec Baldwin's always enjoyable, so you have that going for the film, but even that gets tired after, you know, an hour and a half.
Okay, well, looks like we're staying home this weekend.
Yeah.
Mary Jettikan, host and producer of Fandemonium on HitFix and co-creator and host of Girls on Film on YouTube. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you could watch a new release, a new movie, in your home right after it opened, would you pay more to do that? Hollywood is betting yes. Studio heads are planning to release their movies as video on demand soon after they hit theaters for between $30 and $50 per rental. That seems like a lot, but theater owners are not happy with this idea. They're worried people are going to go for that and not go out to see the movies. Some filmmakers are also against it. This was a big issue at CinemaCon this week. That's an annual convention for theater owners where they get to preview movies before they're released later in the year. CinemaCon wrapped up yesterday in Las Vegas. Benjamin Fritz was there. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, right now you have to wait, what, around 3 months to see a new movie if you want to see it at home? Is that right?
Yeah, that's the minimum. That basically all major theaters in the U.S. won't play a film unless the studios guarantee they won't release it at home on DVD or VOD. For at least 90 days.
Okay. So now the studios want to shorten that window to what around?
Anywhere between 17 and 45 days.
Oh, wow. So that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess theater owners aren't too excited about that.
No, they certainly feel that their business is dependent in large part on theaters being the only place where you can watch the film. They want to sort of preserve what's special about, you know, the big screen experience. And they think if people know they can watch it at home today or in just a few weeks, a lot of them are maybe not going to bother going to the theater anymore.
But would people pay, as I said in the intro, between $30 and $50 to watch a movie at home?
I think there's some people who would. You know, think about that's basically the cost of, depending where you live, let's say maybe 3 theater tickets. And then, of course, you don't have to deal with going out in a crowd or a babysitter. You know, certainly there are people. There are people who have young kids, for example, who, you know, for whom it's difficult to get out of the house. There are people who just hate going to the mall or to the multiplex and don't like the crowd or whatever. So there's certainly an audience. You know, there's debates about how big that audience is. But there are definitely, I think there's undoubtedly some people who would do it.
Right, because then there's the other group of people who like being out, who like the event of being out in public. And
right, I mean, think about teenagers or college students. The last thing they want to do is hang out at home on a Friday or Saturday night.
At least not with their parents.
Yes, absolutely.
Maybe with their friends. Yes. Well, so this is a power play, right? Who has the power here? Because theater owners could say, well, we're just not going to show your movie if you do this.
Yes. Well, that's the question right now, is who has more power. But I think increasingly the studios have power because they're basically willing to risk upsetting theater owners. And, you know, you have to think about Madeline in part, who owns the movie studios now? Universal Pictures is owned by Comcast, which is a cable company that has a big VOD business. Hmm. So to them, growing this is really important. And Warner Brothers is about to be bought by AT&T, which has a big VOD business on their wireless devices. They actually don't care as much about upsetting the theaters as they do about growing their other businesses. So that's certainly one factor in this.
So the theater owners are, I guess, not in a great position. What can they do?
Well, they have two options. One is just to resist it. I think they're realizing that's not going to work. The studios are just not going to stand it anymore. The studios just believe this business, this is too significant an opportunity. And the studios worry that they're going to lose the kind of young millennial consumers who are used to Netflix and Snapchat and getting content on demand on any device they want when they want it, and think the idea of waiting 3 months or more to watch a movie on, you know, on their tablet or game console or whatever is really antiquated, and will lose interest in studio movies as a result if they have to keep waiting. So the studios feel it's so important that you know, they're going to do it. So the theaters can either resist it, which is tough, or they can say, okay, we'll allow you to do this, but we want a cut of the action, basically. You know, mm-hmm. if you're going to release a movie soon after it's in theaters, you should give us 10 or 20% of that revenue.
But why would the studios agree to that if they don't have to?
Because then, you know, then they're doing this as a partnership. Then the theaters will say, we'll play your films, we'll be happy to play them, and we won't get upset at all that you're releasing it at home in just a few weeks. And this will continue to be a cooperative relationship. Whereas otherwise it'll become a really contentious relationship, and the studio and the theaters might not play certain films, so they'll drop them really quickly, and it's going to be difficult for all involved. I think everyone would certainly rather this be continue to be a cooperative relationship.
So I understand some filmmakers are also unhappy with this idea.
Yes, there are certain filmmakers, you know, who sort of believe that the, you know, the movie theater is a cathedral, and that they make films to be seen on the big screen. They don't make films to be seen on phones or tablets. Certainly one of the leaders of this position is Christopher Nolan, you know, the director of the Dark Knight trilogy and Inception and Interstellar. He was here at CinemaCon promoting his new film, Dunkirk, and he made very clear to the crowd, and this crowd was mostly theater owners, so they're very sympathetic. He said, you know, the only platform, and I wish I could express to you the disdain with which he said the word platform. He said, the only platform that I care about is theatrical exhibition. He made very clear that he wants his movies to be seen on the big screen, and he doesn't want people watching them at home, if possible.
Well, at least not at first. But
yes,
I'm sure
right.
He's happy for them to watch these movies at home
eventually,
later.
You know, even he knows eventually that's unavoidable, but he wants to make it clear to people that his movies are made to be seen on the big screen.
That argument has been made in the past, and it seems to be a minority argument.
It certainly is. You know, look, there are a lot of filmmakers who even accept that's a difficult argument to make these days. You know, television is so good, right? There's so many great TV shows on cable and streaming now, that if people want to watch something really good, they don't have to go to a movie theater. They don't have to watch a movie at all. There's so much great stuff to watch, including movies, by the way, Madeline. You know, Netflix is making a lot of original films with big talent, like mm-hmm. Will Smith and Brad Pitt and even potentially Martin Scorsese. There were talks for a film from him that would debut day and date on your Netflix streaming account. So there's so much good stuff to watch at home that it's hard to argue that there's something so special about going to the movie theater anymore. It's a tougher argument to make every day, I think.
Yeah, well, plus the screens themselves are better and bigger at home.
Yeah, right. We have great screens to watch at home. The theaters are trying to compete. You're seeing more and more IMAX screens, more and more recliner luxury seats and surround sound. They're trying their best to make the movie theater something that's distinct and better. But you're absolutely right. The home experience is getting better and better. It's certainly good enough for most people to have to see a movie and really enjoy it.
So we've been seeing this trend for a long time, obviously, of people watching movies at home. How big a deal is this latest iteration?
It's big. You know, people in Hollywood have complained about how they want premium VOD for a long time, but I've never really heard studio executives be so insistent that it's going to happen in the next year with or without the theater's approval. They just feel that it's too important to reach these young millennial consumers and not lose a generation and have them lose interest in Hollywood movies. I think it's very serious it's going to happen, so which is going to transform the business of film. And also, you know, sort of the cultural definition of the film. Is a film something that's primarily made to be seen in a theater out of the home? Or is a film essentially 2 hours of content versus a TV series that's maybe 13 hours of content, and that's the only difference?
Oh, that sounds so antiseptic, calling it content.
it does in a way, you know, and that's certainly one of the arguments going on here, you know, is film something more than just a short TV show?
Benjamin Fritz, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks.
It's my pleasure.
Hi, Jolie Myers.
Hello.
Is your film something more than just a short TV show?
Well, I feel
there
like
a more depressing end
TV
of
is
the
now
show?
A long film. So,
yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. At the top of the show, we talked about Michael Flynn and the congressional investigations into Trump's ties to Russia and all that crazy jazz. Peter Anderson on our Facebook page says, "Loved this segment. The partisan neutrality of the Senate investigation makes me feel like they have damning evidence. Otherwise, it might be more partisan. Eating popcorn while listening to this." And then there's a little popcorn emoji, which I appreciated. Thank you. Christian Carbone says, "I think the way that Sean Spicer and the White House are trying to push the Russian scandal under the rug only makes them seem guilty, even if they're not. They should really take a different strategy here." So if you want to weigh in on that, or film and or TV, get us on Facebook, KCRW, Press Play, Twitter, same thing.
Or if you want to just send us some popcorn. We'll
also
take that.
That, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of, have a great weekend. Watch movies, do whatever you do. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.